What is up, everybody, and welcome back to the Small Lake City Podcast. I'm your host, Eric Nilsson, and today's episode I'm really excited for. It is a topic that I've been wanting to cover since the beginning, but really wanted to wait until I could find the right person to help cover it. And the topic is something near and dear to my heart, mental health. And so the guest today, her name is Natasha Helfer. She is a therapist specializing in sexual trauma, shame, religious transitions, as well as general therapy. So a lot of great topics because a lot of people don't know, but Salt Lake City is right in the middle of what's called the Suicide Belt that runs all along pretty much the Rocky Mountains. And as most people are aware, with the dynamics in play at Utah, especially with religious dynamics, it makes for a lot of specific mental health issues that most other places don't go through. One thing I will say is we do talk about faith transitions and post-Mormonisms, but nothing that should make anyone uncomfortable, but wanted to give everybody a warning beforehand. But let's jump into the convo with me and Natasha. Because I knew I wanted to cover mental health in Utah, because not only is it something I'm passionate about and prioritize, but it's a very unique topic within Utah because of the dynamics that drive it, that make it very unique compared to other geographies, like, so to speak.
Yes.
So what I did was I reached out to all of my therapists I've had in Salt Lake in my adult life, both current and previous. I was like, if you had to have someone who understands the landscape of mental health, who would it be? And Braxton Dutson, my old therapist, like, you got to talk to Natasha. Oh. She knows what's going on and can help a lot. So
love Braxton.
Yeah, me too. Like, he's actually one of my first male therapists that I had. And at first I was kind of dubious because I was raised by pretty much a single mom, two sisters, always been kind of more comfortable with like women, especially like, talking about life. And so he's the first one like, okay, we're good. Like, we can do this. This is fine. So super stoked to have you here.
I'm super excited to be here with you. Thank you.
Yeah, no, so much. And it's interesting because leading into it all, and we were kind of talking about it briefly before, but Salt Lake is a very unique place with mental health. Tell people that we're in like the quote suicide belt unquote. People don't even know what that means or that we're in here. And before we kind of dive into a lot of like the specific stuff about mental health and what you see and what you experience in your practice day to day, we'd love to hear more about kind of how you got here and a little bit of your story. Because if I remember correctly, you're from the Midwest.
Yeah, well, I actually am from the military.
Oh. That's an important distinction.
So I moved all over the place when I was little. I really can't claim one place. But my first experience in Utah was actually in middle school. We were stationed out in Dugway Proving Grounds.
Oh,
so that's, that's out in the middle of nowhere out there in the West. And but we would come into Salt Lake, on weekends and things. So that was kind of my first experience as a youngster with the culture. And then I came back to Utah for my BYU college experience, my undergraduate experience.
Got it.
And then my parents moved here about that same time permanently.
Okay.
So when they retired from the military, they came here to do kind of their second career. And then, then this kind of became home for me as far as where do I go when I go on vacation or where I go to visit family. And so I've been very familiar with the Salt Lake City area for a long time. And then moved here about 3 years ago.
Thanks.
Well, 4 years. When was COVID? you lose track. We're in 2024, I guess. End of 2019 is when I came.
Well, it's so funny now because we've gotten to the point where it's like, oh, wait, yeah, that happened. And when was that? Why? Like, because I saw a post, I think it was this month that marks like the 4 years, 4 years ago, it was declared a pandemic.
Yes, right now in March.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it's nice to know that we're out of that. What kind of places did you, because I assume when you say you grew up in the military, there's a lot of different places that you called home.
Yes.
What were some of those spots?
Oh,
or where
gosh, lots of places. We lived in Kansas, we lived in Georgia, we lived in Massachusetts and North Dakota.
Yeah.
I was born in Germany and then we spent some time in Spain. That was actually not military oriented, but it was education oriented for my dad. That's where he went to medical school. So it's kind of all over the place. Spanish was my first language. My mother's from Argentina and Latina, so it's, white Latina.
Yeah.
And so that was my first language. So yeah, I've kind of been, and I'm not even telling you all the places, New York, Colorado.
Gives you an interesting perspective.
I've been all over the place.
No, that's so fun.
Yeah.
So then you come to BYU, you study here.
Yes.
Your parents, it just kind of becomes a comfortable place just because there are so many people here where you come to visit. And then eventually, obviously, years ago, started to moved here full time.
Yes.
And so at BYU, I mean, is that when you started studying, I mean, mental health therapy, or what kind of led you to want to pursue that as a career?
Yeah, I came to BYU, as most people do in college, thinking you're going to study something and then change a few things along the way. So I think I started as a business major. That was going to be my goal, but that was really horrible for me. I did not like it.
Good to know. Then.
And I took a Psych 101 class, and it was with Tony Ann Roberts, who was a phenomenal speaking teacher and had just started at BYU. She was actually non-LDS.
Interesting.
And she had just some phenomenal perspectives, and she really kind of impacted my desire to dig in deeper into that field. So I got my undergraduate in Bachelor's of Science in Psychology.
Awesome. Yeah, my parents are both medicine-based. My mom's a pediatrician, and my dad was a pediatric neuropsychologist. And it's funny, like, as you grow up, you start to realize kind of why your parents do certain things and, like, see your own traits in them a lot more, just get a little bit more, just pay a lot more attention to it. And, like, that's one thing I've realized from my dad is, like, I love psychology. I love human behavior. I love anthropology. Like, I love seeing how humans are. I'm like, thanks, Dad. we got that there. So you graduated from BYU, and did you just jump into practicing, or did you go back to school again and get a master's or PhD, or what was your path after that?
Yeah, you can't practice as a clinician with a bachelor's level, so I knew I had to go on and get my master's degree in one of the fields, you know, social worker, marriage and family therapy, or clinical counseling. So I took a year off. I wasn't exactly sure what I was doing next. I was in the process of dating and possibly getting married, which I ended up doing, and so and my ex-husband lived in Wichita, Kansas, so I started looking at programs there. And so I ended up going to Friends University for their marriage and family therapy program, which is interesting because Friends University also has kind of a bit of a religious Christian background. It was Quaker-founded back in the day. It's no longer really associated with the Quakers. But so I went from one kind of religious institution to another kind of religiously influenced.
Probably not quite as strict.
Yes, not as strict, but definitely had Christian influence. And like my professors and some of my professors, not all of them, would have kind of some Christian ideologies that would kind of find their way into things that we would talk about. Although nothing that I would consider unethical or that was, you know, too profoundly like, this is how you should do it because it's the Christian way, like that. But just interesting to see how their faith journeys impacted their professional journeys as well.
Yeah, because it's like, because I went to University of Utah, obviously not a religious school.
Yes.
And it's fun comparing experiences to my friends that did go to BYU, because, I mean, obviously it's pretty much down the middle. And it's so funny to, like, just even the thought of being like, oh, you're going to go to your biology class and then you're going to your Book of Mormon class. Like, just for how, and, like, opening with a prayer, like, that just seems so, like, wild and foreign to me, especially when you think about, I mean, BYU and Utah, like, very liberal, not very, but liberal school and conservative school and different approaches. But it's fun that you get to see the kind of two different sides of that same kind of spectrum of being at a religious school and doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, did you like being in Wichita and Kansas, and did that resonate with you, or were you kind of yearning to be other places?
Yeah, I wouldn't say Wichita resonated with me. It's a fairly conservative state, politically and social justice wise, and so those are things that I've always been a little bit more of a struggle in. I trend to be a little bit more progressive, and that was the same case at BYU as well. So it's interesting. I mean, I don't know how much you want to get into this, but So my parents were converts to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is the mainstream religion here in Utah.
Yes.
And so, but we had never lived anywhere around the LDS corridor, right? And so, except for that one time in Dugway.
Just this once. But even then you were so alone. It's not.
Yeah, and there was an LDS influence there. And I remember doing things, you know, in my ward, in my community, my church community, that are very much formative memories for me. But for the most part, as a convert to a religion, a convert family, there's a lot of, you know, trying to figure out the new community, trying to figure out how you fit in and what's the language and how do people do things. And so I definitely felt that throughout my growing up years. So on the one hand, I didn't totally fit in because I didn't know all the things. On the other hand, I didn't fit into the rest of the culture either, because once you tell people, hey, we're Mormon, right, we're LDS, at least out in the outside world, there's quite a bit of distrust, or even, you know, like, I don't know if discrimination is the correct word, because I wouldn't say I was ever formally discriminated against, but just a lot of distrust and wondering, can we, you know, what's that about?
Yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of labels and a lot of,
yeah, a lot of labels,
assumptions,
a lot, jokes,
a lot, yeah.
How many moms did you have?
Yeah, exactly.
I thought that a lot growing up. And so, which was confusing to me because, again, as converts, we didn't have a whole lot of history about polygamy or, you know, understanding kind of the historical nature of what that meant. So I was looking forward to coming to Brigham Young University, and I was like, oh, finally I'll be amongst, you know, quote unquote, my people, you know, and I'll finally not be this outsider. But then I come to BYU and I feel very much an outsider there as well, right? Because I don't fit this kind of classic upbringing or some of the standards.
Or great-great-grandparents weren't pioneers.
Yeah, exactly. We don't have the pioneer history, which is a lot of what people talk about. Even small things, like I would take out my deck of cards and say, hey, let's play gin rummy. And you know, several of my BYU roommates were like, oh, those are of the devil. I'm like, wait, what?
Yeah,
am I doing something wrong? Like, we played cards all the time in my other LDS wards.
Yeah.
You know? So there were some cultural factors just coming here, which is a more mainstream kind of space, that still didn't feel like I fit in. So I didn't look like a lot of the other young women. I didn't act like them. I didn't have the same standards. I had spent a year in Argentina before going to BYU, visiting my mother's family and culture, and had had a lot of freedom, you know, and would be able to go out late at night and go to dance parties with friends. And
doesn't sound very BYU.
Yeah, there was some chaperoning, but you know, I was, you know, living standards and everything, but I had a lot of freedom. And then coming to BYU, it's like 10 o'clock curfew, and you know, boys and girls can't be in the same place as far as dorm rooms. So it just felt very like, oh, wow, this is like taking 10 steps back in how I'm being treated as an adult,
yeah.
An emerging adult. I'm really being treated like a 15-year-old teenager.
Almost like a, yeah, just staying here, don't screw anything up.
Yeah.
Right. Have a good one.
Yeah. So at the time, I internalized a lot of that. It wasn't like, oh, this is weird, or these people are weird, or the church is weird, or the school is weird. It's more like, I'm weird.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. There must be something wrong with me that I'm not fitting into this community.
I mean, that's got to be hard, too, because, I mean, again, BYU is such a place, and, like, I'm definitely generalizing here, but people are pretty much carbon copies of each other. Everybody more or less has the same background, has more or less the same beliefs, more or less agreeing to the same rules and behaviors of, like, the community they're abiding to. And so to be someone's like, oh, I'm, like, not this. It's like just such a contrast to that. So like, even my friends that were like, oh, I'm Mormon, but I'm not like Mormon, like this. You just feel like the outsider because there's literally rules against being kind of like those people, especially having that freedom before, I mean, especially like the freedom of like pre-college where, I mean, if you're in high school, you're under some sort of stewardship of your parents. And then you have this gap year where you're like, I'm going to go down to Argentina. I'm going to go visit my mom's family. I'm going to have so much fun. It's probably like one of the first times where you're like, oh, I'm an adult and can go do things, especially
yeah.
like in a country that rewards and does that so much more and is so much more social. And then you show up in Provo and
yes.
it's gone.
Well, and even countries like Argentina have like humongous support in public transportation. I could go anywhere in the country just by getting on a bus or a train, or, you know, I didn't need to drive a car or have, you know, so I really did have a lot of independence, which was really beautiful. And, came back to a very, you know, very different environment.
So you go to BYU, then we go back to Kansas, and so you get your master's, PhD?
I got my master's degree in marriage and family therapy.
Nice.
Yeah. And then after that, you can, you know, when you get a 2-year master's degree, usually has an internship that's involved with that. And then you have to go forward with usually what's about a 2-year postgraduate degree process of getting your license, which means you have to work under somebody else's supervision. And so I did that as well. And then you can either work for an agency or work for yourself or work for a group practice. So that's the direction I went.
Thanks. And how was those first couple of years when you're, I mean, on your own, did it feel like you wanted it to feel? Was there any kind of differences, or did it meet all your expectations?
Yeah, I always loved being a therapist, a clinician. I always loved the training. I always felt very on the one hand, you know, especially when you're starting, there's a lot of imposter syndrome and like, what am I doing? Do I know what I'm doing? Am I helping people? I was young, you know, sometimes a lot of people go into mental health practice kind of as a second half of life type of a profession. So more than half of my cohort was what I would say like 35 and older. So there I am as a, you know, 23-year-old starting out, you know.
Tell me about your life.
Yeah. Someone you've got a family who's has a lot of issues and children. And, you know, I was just married when I started, so I didn't have any kids or, you know, it's kind of like, oh yeah, let me give you advice on things that I don't have any real personal experience with. But the training I received was very good. What I did start noticing in the Wichita corridor, which is, of course, you know, the Bible Belt, is part of the Bible Belt, is that even though I felt very good about my training, very good about my professors and the supervision I got, pretty quickly I started realizing a lot of my cohorts were evangelical Christian or Pentecostal Christian or, you know, all these different kinds of religions that are more more central to those kinds of geographical areas. And I started seeing the ethical issues that come up when people's religions start interfacing with mental health practice and what people think about, what does this mean for, what does it mean to have good mental health? What does it mean to have good relational health? What does it mean to have good sexual health? And now your religious ideas can get very intertwined with how you're presenting truths that may have more to do with your religious beliefs than actual social science.
Yeah. And I'm sure that's hard, like, because obviously, like, in the Bible Belt, and like you said, in the Baptist, the Pentecostals are very, like, on the Christian, like, called spectrum of, like, high demand, like, they're closer to the top than the bottom. And obviously coming from, I mean, the LDS faith, like, that is one of the most high demanding of them all. I'm sure it was, like, in a lot of interesting perspectives for you to see that in, like, almost like a Petri dish, but not necessarily, I mean, applying to your own life or, like, feeling like it's looking at itself, but you start to make those correlations before. You feel like you had that experience in interacting with that specific population, or do you feel like you already had a lot of that history before because of, like, your life experiences and getting your degrees?
I think that being in that population in particular helped me see how, oh, if I'm not careful, I could have some ethical missteps myself. Mm-hmm. Because, like, if I had done my training here in Utah, my clinical training, and there had been other LDS therapists, and they would have been talking about things that I more resonated with from my doctrinal gospel perspective, maybe I wouldn't have caught that as much. But when I was in this other space with other, you know, other types of Christians, primarily, I didn't really work with very many Muslim or Hindu or other types of religions. Then I could see how they languaged that religious ideas was different than mine. So they would make assumptions that everybody must think this way because that's their majority.
Yeah.
And I'm like, ooh, that's not really how I think about it. And now I can see how you're projecting that onto our client, especially when we're doing co-therapy or we'd have group, you know, sessions where I could see how other clinicians would show up. And that would make me pause and go, I wonder if this is something I'm doing without recognizing it, with my own biases, my own religious biases of who God is, what doctrine is, and how that interfaces with people's lives. And I could see that a lot with even clinicians who might say, well, God doesn't believe that. So just with that sentence, you have a clinician who's assuming there is a God. Mm-hmm. Maybe your client believes in a God or not, and then now you're imposing your sense of God onto another person who may have a very different sense of who God is, right? Some people believe in a loving deity. Some people believe in a punitive deity. Some people believe in a deity that's very involved in their day-to-day lives. Some people believe in a deity that's kind of removed, you know, from caring about small things. And yeah. So it was just very interesting to see those kinds of things pop up where I was like, boy, if I was the client and I had heard a therapist say that one, it wouldn't jive with my beliefs and my values. And two, I would feel uncomfortable. And three, I feel like now you're projecting something onto me that isn't mine to have. So these ethical issues became very, very important to me from a very early stage. And that's significant for my career path, especially coming here to Utah, because then that really propped me up to realize how this does show up mm-hmm. in LDS culture as well with LDS therapists. So now I was like, oh, we do it too.
Uh-oh. I see these trends. Yes.
You know, whereas I don't know if I would have been trained here, if I would have been as adept to recognizing it, because I would be swimming in my own space. But I wasn't swimming in my own space, and I didn't like how that felt. And then I started realizing, oh, I don't like how this feels in LDS land either.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting. Like, A, it's amazing that you have this, like, introspective and perspective of your own biases via seeing what's happening around you, even if you're working with, like, your peers are, I mean, 10, 12, 15 years older than you, that you're like, oh, wait, I see this bias in you that you don't see. And it's interesting when, like, in those perspectives, especially when religion's involved, because this is something I've thought about a lot, is, like, for me, and, like, because I like to consider myself an open-minded person, I like to learn new things, I like to change my opinions based on, I mean, experience and new data that I acquire. But it's interesting when, like, and this isn't a bad thing, it isn't a good thing, there's probably more nuance and context to it, but there's, like, this filter that gets placed on anything that happens. It's like, it has to go through that. Does it align with my religious belief? Does this is this how I perceive the world? And then, because it has to go through there, anything that comes out of you also has that filter that comes out of it. So to your point with your colleague who's like, oh, like, yeah, but that's not how God sees it. You're like, oh, like, there's so many things that just happened in those, like, couple words
yes.
that I can't even have that. But I like that you have this dedication and loyalty to your practice and, like, what you want to do instead of, because you could have easily been like, they're religious, I'm religious, we all believe in a God, like, of course it's going to come into this and move on. But instead you're like, no, like, I want to have my clients and everybody have the best experience possible, because I believe that mental health is important. And one of the key facets of that is having someone help you through that journey when you need to. And someone needs to be that professional and, I mean, dedicated to their craft and their practice and not have their biases get in the way.
Yeah, we're taught to take ethics pretty seriously in any of these master's degree programs. And one of the ethical components is to be able to watch our own self-biases, especially when it comes to things like culture, religion, or sexual orientation, you know, all these different types of ways that people show up that might be very different from how you show up personally. But you're supposed to be able to put your personal kind of beliefs aside to work with the client who's in front of you and their beliefs and their values. And so that's, I took that very seriously. I think I made a lot of missteps, especially at the beginning myself, you know, as I did that work of recognizing my own biases. So I'm not by any means saying, oh yeah, from day one, I had it all figured out. But these were things that I was noticing. And as I noticed them, I started, kind of questioning how I was doing some of my practice as well as what I'd see some of my colleagues doing. And then there's some very clear ways that this shows up with religious therapists in particular. And it's a dilemma, because what we know from the research is that many people feel more comfortable seeing a therapist or even a clergy member for their personal problems that comes from their own religion.
Yeah.
Or that comes from their own worldview. So, you know, Jewish folks might be more adept to look at for a Jewish therapist, right? Or Christian folks might be looking for a Christian counselor or a pastoral counselor, which is usually the combination of an ecclesiastical leader plus a mental health practitioner. LDS folks are usually going to be more comfortable with an LDS therapist. Mm-hmm. So the problem with that makes sense on the one hand. The problem with it is that then the clients are not adept in knowing when those ethical boundaries are being crossed. And that's our responsibility as clinicians. But then I've seen so many clinicians, in a sense, be inept at that as well, that's where I think harm happens without really anybody noticing it. You know, not the client nor the clinician.
There's just so many, it's like...
until I hear the stories later in my office and I'm like, wow, that doesn't sound like that was great therapeutic help.
Well, it's like blind spots on blind spots, which just, it's, I mean, it's not additive, it's multiplicative. And then they're like, why isn't my problems getting, like, I don't feel better. You're like, well, I think there's a couple of things at play. But it's like interesting too, because I remember I had a friend who their dad was getting married and they weren't excited about what was about to happen. I was kind of telling my therapist at the time about it. I was like, yeah, blah, blah, blah. But I think it was fine because she ended up officiating the wedding. And she's like, wait, what? I was like, yeah, the guy's therapist officiated the wedding. She's like, do you know what's wrong with that? I was like, what do you mean? She's like, do you know what duality is? And I was like, refresher, just run it past me really quick. She's like, yeah, like, I am your therapist. I am not your friend. Like, even if I see you in public, I cannot recognize you as such unless you recognize, like, and it was like the first time I realized, I was like, oh, like, not everybody acts as good. I mean, the easiest parallel is like when I went on my mission, it was like, oh, everybody's a good missionary. Everybody does perfect. We're all like singing hymns and holding hands. And then you get out there, you're like, oh no, the bell curve still exists. And I mean, and unfortunately, like, and I've had similar experiences in other, I mean, fields via, I mean, like professional life when I did some market research for medical providers. And there was a guy, we were doing some market research with him, and I would always Google the person just to see their face because I'd be listening and then taking notes. And then I see this thing, it was like, Dr. So-and-so, license removed for 3 years after cutting out wrong kidney. And I was like, I think it's going to be really good. But yeah, I mean, like, and it's hard because a lot of these people, I mean, especially with, again, like these mental health and biases where, I mean, a lot of those religious roots run so deep that you sometimes don't even know that blind spot even exists and is on, like, probably like so much more part of your identity than being a clinician that it probably takes more of the control than that.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I mean, that's why ethics is super important. We're supposed to get continuing education in ethics, so many hours every 3 years. However, at the same time, you know, as I've gone to many ethics conferences and CEs, there's not a lot of information about religion and religion interplay. You know, a lot of times ethics are about confidentiality or dual relationships or don't have sex with your clients, you know, like that. So surprising. We have to repeat that at almost every ethics conference. And I'm like, yeah, but what about these religious biases, you know, that tend to crop up pretty regularly? We're doing better, you know, with ethics around like systemic racism and, you know, being affirming of, you know, LGBTQ plus populations, but even things like that, they think even back when I was getting trained in the 1990s, those things were in our ethical proceedings back then. We still struggle with as a profession to show up in spaces where we're not discriminating in one way or another.
Yeah.
I don't think it's possible for any of us clinicians to be bias free. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's possible. What I do think is possible is for us to be consistently alert to those biases, being open instead of being defensive when we're called out on those, and continue to do the work of improving ourselves throughout our careers.
Yeah, it's like taking a dose of your own medicine.
Yes.
Well, I love that. And I also love, I kind of want to come back to the point about, I mean, taking your practice more seriously, I mean, especially seriously, and showing up as the best you can without biases of your own, which led to you eventually moving to Utah because of it. Because, I mean, was it 2020 or 2021 when everything happened?
As far as my excommunication from the church, that was 2021.
Okay, yeah. Because I don't want to talk about it a ton because there's, I mean, so many articles. I'm sure you've done so many podcast interviews talking about it. But, I mean, essentially, it's like you standing up for your own practice and belief in what you knew was right based on, I mean, social studies and research and standing by that, which is, I mean, admirable, especially when, I mean, a lot of people, to your point, would see those biases and be like, oh, no, maybe I'll be quiet here. Maybe I won't stand up for yourself. But you really use it as a platform to do what you knew or thought was right, even if it didn't end up or ended up with these repercussions that, you know, ended up happening, whether you wanted to happen or not.
Yeah, no, I think it is an important thing to touch on because it's the end of an arc of a very long journey for me. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes as therapists, some of us are trained with this kind of like blank slate approach, you know, don't share much about your own beliefs. Don't share about anything about your politics. Don't make your public opinions public because then that will, in a sense, maybe affect the people who are coming in to see you and they don't feel like they can be open with you about whatever things because of those positions being known. So on the one hand, I understand that. On the other hand, there is some ethics around us as clinicians seeing trends, seeing things that are also being seen in the research. And if we don't speak up and say, hey, this is actually kind of harmful practice, or these issues, you know, these particular things could lead to some negative results, I feel like there's an advocacy component about being a clinician as well. Social workers definitely have that in their ethics, to be advocates for social justice. Those of us in other fields may don't have that quite as much in our ethics, but it's still something to be considering, is how are we showing up politically, legally, and as advocates for mental health as a whole. And so, yes, none of my ideas were mine. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, my support for gay rights, it's not like I came up with gay rights ideas. However, when I did so much of the research, when I would see so many LGBTQ plus folks coming through my office, really suffering, suicidal, having so much family ostracization, especially from conservative religious backgrounds, LDS land included, I could see the impact that was happening for people when we take certain stances within religious communities, like being gay is a sin or acting gay is a sin, which is still the case in many conservative Christian sects that we have here in the United States. And so that has a cost. If we're going to see through the lens of God and through the lens of gospel in this particular way that harms such a large segment of our population, sure, I can just do the triage work, you know, and just sit there in my office quietly and try one by one to see each person that maybe I can help and maybe offer them some different perspectives and some different research and resources. At the same time, like, where's all this bleeding coming from? And that's a more systemic issue. So I did decide to be more public about my positions through my blog. I called it, at the time, I called it The Mormon Therapist. And so I would start talking about some of these issues. I'm like, you know, the way that we talk about these things in our religious circles may have consequences to mental health, relational health, sexual health, spiritual health, mm-hmm. that either we're not addressing or we're ignoring. And I'm not sure that we can ethically do that anymore. And so, yes, I spoke in particular for the support of gay rights and how important that is for the mental and relational health of so many of our community members. I did talk about things like even something as simple as masturbation, which is since the 1950s really seen as normative sexual behavior from childhood on by the Pediatric Association, by, you know, so many different associations, and even seen as, you know, from the World Health Organization, a personal privacy issue, like a personal right. And yet we have so many people that feel very, very guilty, very shameful, now are identifying maybe as addicts even because they can't control a natural aspect of human behavior, which is not meant to be controlled. It's kind of like feeling guilty for every time you feel hungry. Yeah. You know, it's this natural drive. And because you're not, because you're not adhering to a certain standard, now you are not worthy, you're not good, you're evil, you're perverse, you know, all these things. And then you take into account a developmental mind. So a lot of these messages are being doled out at fairly young ages, especially like in our LDS tradition. You start getting asked these questions as early as 11, 12 in regards to what's called the law of chastity in our tradition. And I'm seeing these teenagers coming into my office, you know, self-harming, suicidal, depressed, anxious, scrupulous. And when I really kind of figure out what's going on, not always, but at the heart of many, it was this masturbatory shame that felt like something they couldn't control. They really saw themselves as very, very pernicious and evil in the sight of their God. Mm-hmm. So how is that even affecting their spiritual health? And why are we imposing this as adults who I believe should know better, you know, in 2020? we should know better of the effects that this could have on a developmental person's journey that then can have lifelong effects yeah. for their sexual health, for their sexual relationships, whether or not they can enjoy sex with a partner. And so, yes, I spoke about that too. So again, not my ideas. I mean, these are ideas. This is research yeah. that I'm sharing.
Being an advocate that you know yeah. and you want to be.
And I end up, you know, so then the church or churches have a difficult position when they have kind of this wrestle, which I think has been a centuries, if not millennia old wrestle of, are we going to pick the side of science? Or are we going to pick the side of tradition and what we believe God has told us, right? And so even as something as simple as whether or not the world is round or flat, you know, that was a big deal a long time ago. And that was seen as heresy mm-hmm. to say that the world was round. And for a lot of people, that was like religious blasphemy for somebody to say that's not scientifically correct anymore. And people who had those ideas suffered tremendously. They wouldn't just get excommunicated, they'd get killed. Yeah. And so, so that's a wrestle that's happened forever. And I think sometimes we forget that. Again, it's very easy to look back thousands of years and go, well, those religious people just didn't really quite have the light that we as religious people definitely do. And it's interesting to me how we can't correlate that maybe there's some things within our own religious biases mm-hmm. that we may have wrong too, and we hide behind what I call the skirts of God mm. because it's like, well, God says so I can't change my mind regardless of what science yes. says, even though we have all changed dramatically what we think religious, you know, what was religiously motivated or justified 1,000 years ago about women, about slavery, about all kinds. We've changed dramatically. We right. no longer say, oh, well, but God says it's okay to rape your wife. And so, you know, we've changed our mind about that somehow.
Yeah, right? We've developed a little bit
yes,
past that.
We have developed. So I just think it's always interesting how we as humans, and me included, it's difficult to look at ourselves and our current beliefs through the lens of, I might not have this all figured out. And I think religion in particular has a tendency to lean towards certainty and that we do have it all figured out because after all, we've got God on our side.
Yeah.
Whereas science doesn't get it all right either. Mm-hmm. We've had atrocities through science as far as, you know, lobotomies and all kinds of things yeah. that have happened to people through kind of a scientific lens. However, where that leans is really in challenging the current tradition and trying to find new ways and better ways. And you're rewarded for that. You're going to get a Nobel Peace Prize if you prove somebody else wrong.
Yeah.
Whereas in religious circles, you're going to get disciplined if you're trying to prove, especially ecclesiastical leaders, wrong.
Yes. And it's like, that's one thing I've been thinking about a lot too, is like because I love arguing in a sense of sharing beliefs, thinking through things, I mean, edifying each other, not necessarily like, you're wrong, I'm right, here's where we're going to fight, just like learning from other people's points of views. And while, I mean, I have a lot of religious friends, a lot of LDS friends, it's always interesting because, like, one thing I'd always try to prove to people, like, especially against, like, a religious belief, and being like, oh, well, I mean, whether it's abortion, LGBTQ rights, like, gay marriage, whatever, what I've realized is you can never go against someone's belief in God. Because for them to overcome that, then they would have to overcome their belief in God, which is so strong and palpable that, we can't go anywhere else here. I'm not going to just yell at a brick wall and go through the definition of insanity
yeah.
for my own ego.
It's like, a trump card.
Exactly.
When you pull out the God card, it's a trump card.
Exactly. And so you go through this experience, I mean, to your point of when you go against a religious entity, especially ecclesiastical leaders, there's usually a discipline involved. Which led to, I mean, your own excommunication, and then correlating moving to Utah, and then to help, I mean, with a lot of, I mean, continuing in your practice of, I mean, sexual health, religious transitioning, marital help as well. I mean, did that just add like a lot of fuel to your fire, or like kind of want to be more specific in kind of these LDS dynamics in Utah, or how did that change your point of view of what you wanted to do in your role in it?
Yeah, I obviously I did not want to be excommunicated. I felt like, you know, I valued my membership in the church, and I also valued my critical thinking skills from my education, and I felt like those two things could go hand in hand. Not everybody agreed with that. So I felt like I was already doing the work that I wanted to do. I was already working with lots of people. I mean, we know that this is kind of like nationwide and even global trends, that people are becoming less affiliated with religious organizations. That doesn't necessarily mean that people are less affiliated with spirituality, or that they don't believe spirituality is important in their lives, but less adherence to being part of an organization. And so we're seeing some numbers kind of decrease in almost all age groups, older age groups not as much, but definitely younger age groups, in how they affiliate with religion in general. That's happening within the LDS church as well. And so I felt like, as a good clinician, I should be able to sit with an LDS believer just as much as I should be able to sit with an LDS or, you know, post-Mormon, and offer them good clinical work regardless. And that I should be able to understand, you know, the values and the beliefs of either people. And so I was already doing a lot of mixed faith marriage work, for example. That's a huge issue that we're currently having here in Utah, that mixed faith marriages are on the increase, as far as I can tell. And when you have one person leaving a religious tradition and one person feeling very confused or betrayed or worried about that, that is a moment for any relationship where you're going to have some struggles. And what does this mean for us? And what does this mean for our parenting? What does this mean for our values and our path forward? And what does this mean for us even within the construct of having, in LDS language, a celestial marriage? You know, like, what does this mean for the afterlife even? So these are really hard, heart-wrenching, you know, things that are happening in these marriages. And I always felt very strongly that, granted, there's lots of reasons why people separate and divorce, but I would hope that this wouldn't be the one reason why people would say, well, we're no longer compatible. Like, could we figure out a way to have a successful mixed faith relationship? And many people do have that and are very capable of that, especially when given skills and strategies, and, you know, we can normalize the situation for them and say, look, you're not the only ones in this position, et cetera. So I was already doing mixed faith work with families and marriages. I was already supporting people who wanted to leave the church and understand, even though I didn't want to leave the church, I could understand why people would, especially, again, if there's been some harm, LGBTQ folks in particular, a lot of people who identify as women with feminist issues and just not feeling like they're being treated, you know, equally or fairly. And that would be things. There's all kinds of reasons why people become affiliated, disaffiliated, historical reasons, social justice reasons. And so I could handle that. I could handle, whereas some of the stories I was hearing from people is, like, for example, this was not an LDS couple, but an evangelical couple who said that their evangelical therapist, who was seeing them as mixed faith, the husband was leaving their church and the wife was not. And as they were leaving a couple session, the wife was asked to just stay back for a few minutes. And this evangelical therapist said, look, to tell you the truth, I don't think that it's good for you to stay with somebody who's not aligned with God. That is not ethical.
No.
Right? That is imposing your religious beliefs onto a couple's marriage. They had children. That's blowing up, or potentially blowing up, something very tender and that's very complex. And now one person's religious bias is, you know, not that just because the therapist said it that they would do it, but it's influencing.
And especially like an ecclesiastical leader like that, that has...
Well, she wasn't an ecclesiastical leader. Just she, was a, okay. She was a therapist.
Got it.
Right. Ecclesiastical leaders will do this too.
Yes.
Of course, they're not under the same ethics.
Exactly.
So I guess you can do unethical things that I would consider unethical,
yes,
as an ecclesiastical leader, like saying, oh, you should leave your spouse. And I've heard that too. And I've also heard of many ecclesiastical leaders who are very supportive of mixed faith relationships. So that's an example. Another example, I would say, I had a transgender person who said, yeah, I went to what was supposedly an affirming therapist. They were saying I'm LGBTQ affirming. And then when they brought up, you know, I've really been hurt in the church, you know, and started talking about those kinds of issues and the types of discriminations that they felt in the church, this therapist got very defensive about the church. This is an LDS therapist. Mm. And just saying, well, but no, the church is really good. Maybe some people in the church maybe are not great. And really missing the systemic,
yeah,
issues that have been happening with gender, messages around gender in particular, that are very harmful to our transgender members and who are LDS. So then they're coming to me and telling me how upsetting this session with this therapist was, because they felt so unseen, so non-validated, et cetera. So those are just a few examples of how these things show up.
Yeah, and like, yeah, like, because I've gone through my faith transition, and I mean, that was, I mean, anybody who goes through it, it's a whirlwind of life, like going from eternal perspective to, I mean, you can keep that, but everything is now up for discussion. You feel like you're on your own, but you've never been able to trust yourself in that same way. And now you're like the only one going through that. And then you have to navigate family dynamics, friend dynamics. Oh, all of a sudden the ward friends aren't showing up in the same way and they're looking at you differently. Like it changes your entire life.
It does. It does. So going back to your question, as far as the work I was doing before versus,
yeah,
after my excommunication, I don't really see my work being much different, other than I think what the church did or was trying to do and probably was successful in doing by excommunicating me. What does that mean? They're really discrediting me, right? They're,
yeah,
discrediting me as a professional. So if you're a believing member of the church, you're going to look at Natasha Helfer and go, well, but she was excommunicated. Why would I go to an excommunicated member who might lead,
yeah,
me astray, who might give me bad advice?
It's almost like this Mormon scarlet letter that was placed on you.
Sure. So I do find that. I still work with mixed faith couples quite a bit. I work with Katie and Alan Mount, who run Marriage on a Tightrope. They do an excellent job. It's a podcast for mixed faith couples in particular, where they really have tried very carefully and intentionally to allow both people to have their side, their voice, their hurts, their concerns, and I love working with them because that's what I believe in.
Yes.
You know, giving both people the right to their belief systems. You know, a believer has a right to be a believer, and a non-believer has a right to be a non-believer. And then how are they going to manage that as a couple? And when you have skills and support and help, that can go much more smoothly than when you're being told kind of ridiculous things,
yeah,
or feel like, you know, oh, we're doing something wrong. So I work with them on that project. It probably has opened me up more. I mean, I was working with issues like, not issues, but themes like non-monogamy, transgender folks, when I was an LDS therapist, right? So I didn't. It's not like, oh, I'm LDS, I can't deal,
yeah,
with that presentation.
Yeah.
That would be unethical,
exactly,
right? So I need to be able to put my own standards or beliefs aside. So now, you know, even though it's discredited me, it also has opened up new avenues where I'm more able to speak freely, to talk more, even more about things that I think are important, especially in the field of sexuality and sexual health. And the wide variety of folks that show up in ways that are very different than maybe the standards of one church.
Yeah. No, I like that. And I like that, I mean, you're in like the quote trenches of it all, because it is a lot of hard conversations. It's a lot to deal with. And it is a lot of help that people really do need in that moment. Even like LGBTQ and other minorities and groups in general, like everybody needs someone who doesn't have that bias, who can show up for who they need them to be and help them through this process. Like, I can't imagine going through anything like that and have my therapist be like, well, but not like that. Like, no, I don't think you're right. Or I have, that's not what I think. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it doesn't necessarily be, need to be religious, but whatever bias that could be that comes in, it has got to be tough. And I love that, like, the topics that you cover, because a lot of them are so relevant in Utah right now. I mean, I think everybody, no matter if you're LDS, non-LDS, post-Mormon, never-Mormon, you do see these trends in, like, religious participation is down. People are seeking for community outside of a religious organization. I mean, even within Utah, I mean, you see church numbers going down, and now the LDS population is no longer the majority in Salt Lake City. And so it's interesting to see these trends happen, but also, I mean, a lot of the things that are happening and have happened play a large impact into the landscape of mental health here.
Yes.
And so I guess, I mean, kind of diving into that a little bit more, I mean, how do you see what happens in Salt Lake and, I mean, broader Utah are so different from the mental health perspectives and the drivers of those compared to other places that you maybe lived, worked, or have colleagues?
Yeah, so I actually do see a lot of similarities between what I call, you know, the Bible Belt and the Book of Mormon Belt. But where we see some very stark differences is in areas outside of that. One very stark example is this issue of, and I'll put it in air quotes, porn and sex addiction. That's not really something, you know, if you're talking to somebody in New York who's offering mental health services and you're like, hey, I need help with porn and sex addiction, they're going to look at you like, wait, what are you really talking about? Like, that's not really a thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas, of course, here in Utah and in Wichita, Kansas, and in Nebraska, and all this, like, you've got entire centers centered around this type of treatment approach, you know, and so that's why I get very passionate, is I feel like my community that I come from, excommunicated or not, I still consider it my community.
Yeah.
So my community is vulnerable to approaches to mental health, and especially sexual health, that are just not based in evidence-based research and science. And so we have a lot more anxiety around sexuality in these communities. We have a lot high, you know, different standards about how people should behave sexually, and that gets conflated with illness.
Mm.
If you're not following the standards of the church, there
must be
something wrong with you. You must be sick. Whereas really it's like, you know, I mean, just to give an example, I mean, like, Orthodox Jewish folks don't believe in eating pork, right? And many of us wouldn't even think twice about that. And so if somebody's struggling with that in the Orthodox Jewish community and they're like, oh, every month I have a pork sandwich and I really shouldn't be doing that, the rest of the world would be like, oh, you have a pork addiction.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be like, oh, you're having a struggle with your kind of Orthodox beliefs matching your lived human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a struggle. That's real. That's important to that person. But we're not going to now name it a pork addiction.
Yeah.
And that's what happens basically within these communities, not just in LDS land, but in conservative, you know, kind of religious spaces, is we have this propensity to, in particular, pathologize sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
We did that with homosexuality for a long time.
Oh, yeah.
in here in Utah and in other places. I believe it was a mental health disorder even in the science books until the 1970s.
Wow.
So science has improved, right?
Yes,
science has been challenged. Science rewards challenge.
Yes.
But in these religious communities, there's this double down effect. No, we're going to double down. We're really serious. This is not okay behavior. And then where I think it's really complicit is when LDS or Christian therapists basically go along with religion and saying this is so wrong, but now we're going to put a clinical label to it as well.
And especially when, I mean, and we touched on it a little bit when you're talking about, like, masturbation and shame, especially in religious context, not necessarily has to be in LDS context, but most very conservative religions will do so. And then you pair that with, I mean, like, things like the shame of pornography and calling it an addiction and all of this is usually done during some of those, like, forming years of someone's life. And it's usually during those adolescent years where, I mean, during that time, you are still downloading the world around you and how to perceive it and how you fit into it. And to be automatically deemed as like, oh, hey, by the way, there's something terribly wrong with you. You have to go see someone for this because you have a problem.
Yes.
And, like, to have that be placed on your identity and not know what to do with it, I mean, that's hard.
Very difficult. And you don't have the developmental maturity to really know how to manage or deal with that. Mm-hmm. You just really are, what you're downloading is that there's something really inherently wrong with me.
Yeah.
And not only is mommy mad at me or my bishop is mad at me, but the all-knowing, all-seeing God is mad at me. Right. Right. So there's no escape from this kind of internal judgment that gets internalized. And that's so much of the work that we're doing in uncovering shame and working with internalized shame for many times, you know, years to undo that kind of internalization that does happen at very young ages.
Yeah. Because I have so many friends and acquaintances that, I mean, still struggle with it to this day. Like, they went through this process in their adolescence and formative years, and it still plagues them. They still don't think they're like a good person or normal, quote unquote,
yes.
But they were told that at one point, especially like to your, like the examples you use. I mean, if you go through this like shame process, it's like, let's just go for sake of the argument, like the LDS perspective of it. Like, your parents are going to shame you until you go talk to the bishop. The bishop's going to probably shame you, and they're probably going to say some, or quote some scriptures and talks, which then affirms that, like, oh, the religious leaders and God is looking down at me. But hey, let's go see a professional. And now this professional is now saying the same thing if it's someone that comes from that same religious background.
Right.
And all of a sudden, everyone...
Everybody around you is complicit in this idea that there's something genuinely, inherently wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
Because maybe you masturbate once a week or once a month or even once a day. And you might be curious about explicit materials,
mm-hmm.
which is actually very normative behavior. I'm not saying people need to love explicit materials or need to agree with watching explicit materials, but to make it an illness when that doesn't even really exist clinically, then that really becomes the problem and where I think a lot of therapists are doing harm.
Yeah.
And like I run a male sexual shame group specifically for folks who have gone through these 12-step programs or, you know, sex addiction programs. The LDS Church has come up with kind of their own 12-step program in the last, I'd say, 20 years or so. And the amount of both rage and actual sobbing that happens in that group of mine and these men who are working through this type of shame in their 30s, 40s, 50s, is extremely humbling for me to be a part of that, but then also speaks to the internalized damage and how oftentimes that internalized shame does lead to non-adaptive behaviors like secrecy, betrayal, hiding, you know, and which can affect their spouses, mm-hmm. right? Because they've learned from an early age, you either stuff this in and don't let anybody know about it because you'll be extremely punished or divorced or you won't be able to date the person you want to date. So you just
see your family
to keep
for eternity.
It super secret. Or you become kind of like a serial confessor, which then has its own implications too about, you know, like you're saying, just putting yourself consistently into these spaces where people tell you you are not living to a certain standard that you should be living. And anytime we're shitting on ourselves, that's not a great space to be on for internalized shame.
Yeah. And we talked about it when we walked in, but like a lot of people don't even realize that, I mean, Salt Lake City, Utah, and Utah is right slap dab right in the middle of the suicide belt, mm-hmm. in the Rocky Mountains. And so, I mean, you could say, argue causation versus correlation, kind of the drivers that we've talked about, but regardless, we're in a place that has a higher predisposition to, I mean, suicide, which, I mean, goes down the whole funnel of suicide, mental health, I mean, like you alluded
yes.
to, of anxiety and all of these myriad of issues
yes.
that play such a huge issue, I mean, a part in, I mean, our personal lives, whether it's us personally or someone that we know or someone that we care about or a spouse or family member, whatever that might be. And it's always interesting because, like, we see all these studies recently. It's like, oh, men are the loneliest they've ever been. People have the least amount of close connections that they've ever had. And it's so easy to look at that and be like, oh, yeah, but not my friends or not me or not anybody else. But you realize you're like, oh, like, everybody is kind of going through this in their own way. And to assume that no one I know is a dangerous road to be on until something, like, terrible happens. And then you have to look at yourself and be like, oh, like, and I'm not saying you could have saved someone or you could have done something, but I always, I don't know, the people I care about and the people in my circle, I always try to do a mental check-in every now and then, just make sure everyone's doing okay.
Yeah, I mean, it is complicated. Suicide is a complicated topic. It's usually multifaceted. There's some research to show that for some reason, higher altitude places in the world tend to trend to have a higher rate of suicidality. And I think a lot of people like to just blame that only and say, no, it's not all these policies that we have or these legal things that we have. But the research is very clear, for example, for LGBTQ plus folks, that non-affirming spaces will increase suicide rates by like 5 to 10 times,
wow.
Right? And depending, especially if you're transgender versus gay, versus transgender communities at most risk for this. And we just passed here in Utah horrific legislation around gender issues, around who can use a bathroom. So it would not be surprising to me that this, you know, rates unfortunately increase in particular for that population, because they're living in a space where they're not supported and they're actually afraid. I've had people tell me, I'm afraid to travel because if I'm going to go into southern Utah and I have to go to the bathroom, yeah. Am I going to be accosted? And I've heard of people even moving from Utah because of these reasons. I have a transgender child myself who moved from Utah specifically because just not feeling safe.
Yeah.
So those are very, very difficult issues. I think too, another thing that is usually very typical in these high demand religious corridors is this relationship with perfectionism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, trying to be a certain standard. So we definitely have research here that, for example, we're, I think, only second to areas in California for plastic surgery, for, you know, wanting to look a certain way. So there's a lot of pressure to look a certain way, to be a certain way, to present a certain way. I think this in particular affects people in female bodies.
Yes.
And so this pressure to, you know, be considered beautiful or be considered the perfect mother, to have to somehow love mothering, to have the perfect home, to have everything in order, can really put a huge burden of, again, feeling like I'm not enough,
yeah.
You know, in a lot of ways. So we know that we have a lot of antidepressants being prescribed here, sometimes in more rates than in other states. So there's a lot of factors, right? There's a lot of factors. And we also know that there's pretty good, I'm not sure if specific research or anecdotal research, but that, you know, here in LDS, in the LDS corridor, we have General Conference twice a year, which is the meeting where the main leaders of the church will speak. And for pretty consistently for the last, like, I would say 10 years, there's been anti-LGBTQ messaging. There's been anti-doubt messaging.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a doubter, if you're leaving the church, there's a lot of messages that in a way put families in kind of a predicament,
yeah.
Because now it's like you're being told not to trust people who leave the church. You're being told not to pay attention to people who leave the church. So people who, if that's your husband or your mother,
yeah.
Or your son, you know,
or your
son, now
all
of a sudden there can be some real difficulty there. And we know that the suicide hotlines receive more calls on those weekends than any other weekends.
Interesting.
And throughout the year. So there are issues amiss.
Yeah. I think that's so interesting because, like, it's hard because, I mean, one of my friends, for example, went through a faith transition, ended up leaving the church. And it was hard for them because, like, they always wanted to share, like, why. Not necessarily trying to be like, Mom, I'm trying to tell you why you shouldn't do this anymore. But, like, I just want to be understood because I don't want to look down as this, like, enigma or, like, this, I mean, second-class citizen. But then it's hard. And, like, that's one thing that, like, if I would implore, I mean, active members of the LDS church is, like, just listen to the story. Like, hear people out because, I mean, we're all trying to act with good intent. No one is trying to, like, destroy the world or make the world a terrible place. Obviously, there's exceptions to all of that. But, like, we all want what's right for us. We want what's right for our communities. We want what's right for our loved ones. And that can only happen, or any relationship, really, with good communication. And so, I know it's hard for a lot of people who are active to say, because again, like there's so many themes of doubt, so many themes of like, oh, they leave because of this, or this is why they do that. And it's like, oh no, actually, if you asked me, I would tell you why. But if you're going to trust them instead of like your friend, mother, son, whatever that relationship might be, like that's hard to have that placed in front of them. And so I think something as similar, I mean, as simple as hearing someone out, hearing their story is a good thing to listen to. And again, like it doesn't have to be these details of like, guess what I found out about Joseph Smith, but being like, hey, like there's some things that didn't make sense. That doesn't align with my values and like the experiences that I've had in my life. And so I went down a road and I did a lot of digging and I found it wasn't for me. It's not like, well, I thought alcohol would be fun or like sinning is really cool and I don't want to do this. Like it's, and so I think there's definitely a room for a lot, I mean, just an olive branch between the two groups, because there's always a lot of friction in Utah. I always joke that there's only three types of people in Utah. There's Mormons, ex-Mormons, and Californians. And so with like the Mormons and ex-Mormons, like it's, there's always this friction, and like sometimes it's more passionate than others, and sometimes it's a little more passive, but there is kind of this like unspoken friction that I don't think needs to necessarily happen. And there's a lot of room for improvement is, I mean, accepting both groups of people and moving on in our prospective lives without telling someone like, oh, you can't leave the church alone, and or you can't leave me alone. Like, and it just like doesn't go anywhere. So I think there's room for improvement on everyone to just relax, but at the same time, accept people for who they are and not just what their religious belief might be.
Yeah, it just reminds me of the song, like, Can't We All Get Along?
Still relevant.
And I mean, I think we have to note that we are all humans. None of us escape that reality. And group dynamics really are at play. And if you educate yourself on things like groupthink and group dynamics, it's very common to other people. And this trends to be more the case the more high demand a culture is.
Yeah.
And that can be true in politics, that can be true in religion, that can be true in cultural, you know, arguments. So it's not a religious-only problem, but it definitely is something that we see here a lot. And I agree, there's a lot of assumptions being made. There's a lot of ignoring or kind of like gentle ostracizing.
Yeah.
I say gentle because, you know, there are religious communities like the Amish that, you know, formally ostracize a person from ever being able to see their family again if there are differences of beliefs. We don't have a great track record as humans of getting along with people with different beliefs than ours. And that's a problem.
Yes.
And you can see, I mean, that's what causes wars.
Millions of people have died simply because of that.
Right. And so that's sad. And I do think we have an opportunity here, in particular in this regional area, to do more olive branching between faith communities, between non-faith communities. And where I see some lacking in that is really from the top echelon of the LDS Church. I think that there's lots of people on the ground, you know, grassroots movements, even amongst LDS folks that are very much trying to do interfaith community work. But again, when top leaders every 6 months give messages that are very provocative and very non-branch forming, that can be a real problem because they're seen as the spokespeople of God himself. Right?
Yeah. Like even my oldest sister, who's an active LDS, mother of three, I was talking the other day. I was like, oh, like, what are you up to today? She's like, oh, well, I'll get kids out the door. But then I have my like Bible study with my mixed faith group. I was like, wait, hold on. What? She's like, oh yeah, this Bible study where there's like, I mean, gardeners, garden variety of different faiths. And we all come in, sit and talk about our perspective. Like, that is so great. Like, thank you so much for doing this.
Yeah.
Because it's so good to understand even like, again, like even within the subset of religion of Christianity, of how different that can be and how pigeonholed people can be in their own communities and not want to branch out, like there's so much more in common than you think.
We have so much more in common as humans than we do different, but boy, are we focused on what's different. And that's a primal response. That's a self-protective response. When there's a difference, it could mean danger. It's like the deer in the woods, and all of a sudden they hear that twig snapping, and all of a sudden they're alert, and they're looking around, what could happen? And so we have to learn how to get past some of those primal responses and get more into relational intelligent responses.
Yes. Yeah, because to your point, like all of these almost freeze, fight, or flight reactions that we have for survival, at one point very valuable, kept us alive. Humans are doing great. But there's also like, and like one of my like personal beliefs and probably a little bit more, I don't know the word, but more fringy, let's say, is like, I fundamentally believe like since, let's call it the Industrial Revolution to now, we've tried to evolve so much, but we haven't been able to have that like consistent time of millions of thousands of billions of years before from Neanderthals to now. But now we have to go through this conscious mental evolution to realize like, oh, all of these things that we've been predisposed to follow and these triggers in our brains aren't doing what we need them to do. Because at the same time, like if you were to put, let's use a cute animal. I don't know why my brain's going towards raccoon, but we're going to go with raccoon. If you put a raccoon in a box with like all of these like ads and flashing lights and expectations, like it's going to freak out. And so again, like with humans, because we've been forced into all of these different scenarios and changes to like our species, we're starting to freak out a little bit. And like part of that is, hey, we have to like normalize what like these responses aren't the same that they need to, which it historically with like evolution, it's been consistent because it's been over time. It's been through generations and generations of people coming through it. But now I feel like it's this almost personal responsibility people have to take. Be like, oh, I need to do the work. I need to understand who I'm at. I understand what my triggers are and where I'm going. But it takes, identification of those things, willingness to do it and willingness to change to do make that happen. Yeah. But it is worth it 10 times out of 10. Or I'll say 9 times out of 10, because there's not really as well.
Right.
So we're in an interesting time of human history.
We are definitely in an interesting time, yes. And some of these things were more helpful when we were fighting saber-toothed tigers than our own spouses or family members.
Yes.
Although we've been fighting them for historical, decades as well. Millennia.
You pick up any historical book and you'll find... There's a quote from Will Smith I liked. I mean, this was... probably like 10, 15 years ago, but I think he was accepting an award, maybe an Emmy, I can't remember. But he said, there's two things that I always do. It's read and run. Reading, because all of our problems have been solved before for the most part. We just got to go remember how we did it in the past. And two, running, because there's this voice in the back of your head that tells you to stop. And if you can keep running and ignore it, then you can pretty much do anything in life. And so, again, we just need to keep learning and realize, like, because, again, you pick up, like, the history of Benjamin Franklin, the history of Alexander the Great, the history, like, whatever geography, time frame, whatever, these things are still going to evolve. Mm-hmm. Like, there were still religious wars then, there's still religious wars now.
Yeah.
And we keep finding ourselves in these cycles of problems, but, again, we just need to realize we're not at that place anymore, but it can't happen as broadly as we'd like. So, Natasha, thank you so much. I always end with two questions for all the guests. Firstly, if you could have someone on the Small Lake City podcast and hear more about their story and what they're up to, who would you want to hear from?
Wow. I could give you so many cool people. So, I've heard a lot about from her. I consider her a friend, but you should have Lisa Diamond on.
Mm.
That's an excellent person. You should have Braxton Dunson on.
Yes.
You should have Kristen Hodson on. There's just so many wonderful people here that are so exciting and interesting and doing fabulous work.
I agree. It's a great place to start. And then secondly, if people want to find out more about the work you're doing, your practice, what's the best place to find you?
Yeah, the best place to find me is either natashahelford.com or my group practice is Symmetry Counseling, and you can find us at symcounseling.com. And we really do work in that intersection. We specialize really in that intersection between mental health, religious transitions or religious journeys, and sexuality. And so many things fall into those categories. I mean, we see general mental health issues as well, and depression, anxiety, PTSD, etc. But it's hard sometimes to find a place that really specializes in those intersections. So we're really specialized. I'm really proud of so many of the providers I've trained. We are also currently starting ketamine services through our practice, which is so interesting to see how the world of psychedelics and things can really shift, kind of specifically things that are stuck in our thinking, which is so much about what therapy is about, is trying to get unstuck in the way that we currently think. And, the, you know, things like ketamine and other substances as well have really been shown to help us kind of remove our almost like consciousness.
Like, just dissociate from this for a second.
Yes, and gives you a break and gives you a different perspective. And I just saw in the news that MDMA and psilocybin are being approved here in the state of Utah for at use of hospitals for now, for hospitals and university hospitals. And so that's really interesting to see how that is going to really transform a lot of what we do in different therapeutic approaches. So we're really proud at Symmetry Counseling to be kind of, you know, involved in this ketamine journey and helping people have not just the medical component. Like, a lot of places you just go in and get the ketamine infusions or injections or however it's administered, but to really have the guiding and the integration work and the intentional work that is so to take advantage of that new neuroplasticity that your brain is taking, you know, is having this experience that can last for months, even after a ketamine session. And the research is really showing that when you combine the two, it's not just the medicine, it's not just the therapy, but as usual, it's both at the same time, that your effects are so much better and longer lasting.
It's interesting to see, because I mean, there's so much interesting research in, like, the preliminary findings of, I mean, it's funny, like, to put in the context of war on drugs, where it's like, hey, we lost, but we found some interesting things out that we're going to benefit from. And so I think there's the one documentary that always comes to mind for me is, like, Psychonauts, I think, where he talks about all of the medical applications of psychedelics. So if you're curious, lots of good research out there.
Dr. Groff, and I just saw him in a training, so that, he's much older now, but boy, he was really involved in the initial research back in the, you know, 60s and 70s, and really exciting work. One other shout out I want to give is to the Mormon Mental Health Association. So that's an association I founded about a decade ago, and that's a group of, it's a secular organization, and it's really meant to attract therapists and clinicians who are working with LDS or LDS adjacent folks, post-Mormons, FLDS, you know, kind of whole gamut, and want to do so ethically and competently. So it doesn't matter if you come from LDS background yourself, but, you know, if you're working here as a therapist, you may want to get involved, because we offer very specific trainings on working with people who have had experiences or backgrounds in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and the FLDS cultures and all different kinds of Mormon adjacent spaces. So that's something I'm very proud of as well, because that's really trying to, you know, that's really trying to, like, challenge this, what I started out saying is, like, can we do good work within a religious community without imposing healthy religious bias ourselves.
Absolutely. It's like such a, I love that it's such a core value to you, and you've done so much work around that. Yeah. I like when people are ethical and competent. That's a good combination. The more organizations we can have that go towards ethics and competency.
Yes.
There we go. but no, that's great. No, Natasha, this has been so great. I love your perspective. I love your background and everything that's led you to do all the great work that you're doing now. If you're someone who's going through a transition or needs some help, there's so many great resources. So reach out. Life is a lot easier when you have professional help when you need it. And I'm speaking from experience on that one. So.
Yeah, well, thank you. I love my work. I love Utah. I love the mountains. I love, you know, we have such a beautiful diversity here in the state of geography. And I'm concerned about our lake, and I'm concerned about our air. But I really hope that we can get on top of those issues, because I hope to live here till I'm a really old lady.
I'm with you, too. This is home until I'm not an active member of this planet anymore.
Yes.
And so I agree. We need to take care of everything that makes it great. We don't need to get rid of it just because we were bad stewards.
Yes.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Natasha. It's been great. Great to know you, and great to hear everything that you're working on.
Thank you so much. This was lovely.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Salt Lake City Podcast. Don't forget to like, follow, review, subscribe, and share this episode with your friends. And we'll catch you next week. We'll see you there.